Take care of your body. It's the only place you have to live. Jim Rohn.
Man's time here is finite, but the influence of a man is infinite. The question is, what shall we do with the daylight that remains?
When it comes to politics, find a middle ground. Think of politics like a circle where the pendulum is swinging at the bottom, and if it swings too far to the left, you basically end up with a very similar thing as if you swing too far to the right. And somewhere down in the middle is where things seem to work the best, where we have a lot of freedom and we have a lot of respect. We're also conscious and aware of other people's life circumstances, advantages and disadvantages in a variety of different scopes of life. So to sort of go down that road in some sense, I want to use diet culture. It's kind of a funny thing, right? Diet culture. In some cultures in the past, and even today in China or North Korea, being somewhat fat is a sort of a sign of your wealth, that you're doing better than most financially and you have the ability to eat more than you actually need. So being overweight has had its moments of being a status symbol. But as we've come into modern day society, being overweight is considered an epidemic. It's a problem. And as science progresses, we learn more and more the effects of being overweight or obese and some of the consequences that holds. But that doesn't mean we need to shame the hell out of people that are overweight. And that's where diet culture kind of took hold. People feeling ashamed of themselves, being shamed by others, being shamed on commercials, being shamed in public for being overweight. And those things are not helpful to anyone. However, fighting too far on the other end and saying that being overweight has nothing to do with a person's health, that's just how they are, and that fatness has nothing to do with health, and what, you know, some of those claims that we're going to read here, that's also not accurate. So we need to sort of find this middle ground where we understand that obesity is a problem, and that, as the quote that started this episode, you know, you only have one body to live in. And if you can't take care of that body, you're going to have a shortened life, and it will also impact a lot of other things in your life. I just made a post on Instagram not too long ago that basically said physical health makes everything in life better. And I truly believe that. Like, your relationships will be better if you're physically healthy. Your vacations will be better if you're physically healthy. The sports and activities you attend and participate in and things like that will be better if you're physically healthy. I mean, I've seen people who can't even walk up the bleachers because of their body weight. And then you see other people having a great time running up and down the bleachers, right? That's a very simple observation in life. I had a neighbor years ago when I was in college. They had, we both had kids about the same age. They were like 2-3 years old. And I would go out back and play baseball and run around with my kid. And this neighbor was humongous, and his kid took off for the road, and he was too slow to catch a 3-year-old. Now, luckily, that little boy didn't get hit by a car, but just to think that he could not protect his own child because his obesity was so out of control, that's a sign that life could be better. So let's jump into a few articles. I've got a whole bunch of different articles I want to read you some snippets of and sort of demonstrate both sides of where this diet culture is coming from and the battleground that is being fought here. So if you Google diet culture, the definition is, diet culture is a social expectation that tells us how we should eat and look. I think you should emphasize the look thing. And that if our bodies look a certain way, we are more accepted. Diet culture is dangerous and could harm people of all sizes, sex, and age. So I want to read you a couple of articles. Here's one from NPR. It says, If you've made a resolution to lose weight or get fit this year, you're in a very big boat. In 2022, nearly half of New Year's resolutions in the US were based on fitness and 40% were based on weight loss. We spend over $30 billion on diet products annually and an estimated 45 million Americans diet every year. The author says, I know I have. And if you're reading this, maybe you have too. There are an endless number of reasons why you might want to change your body. That holiday weight, your dating profile, medical issues, your new bathing suit, but the real culprit is usually diet culture. Diet culture is that collective set of social expectations telling us that there's one way to be and one way to look and one way to eat, and that we are a better person, we're a more worthy person if our bodies are a certain way, says UK-based body image researcher Nadia Craddock. And it's a shapeshifter. You might think you're not subscribing to diet culture, but rather are focusing on your health or fitness. It's just a rebranding, says Craddock. These days, she says, the diet industry has adapted its messaging to be less blatantly about appearance and more about the in-vogue ideal of health and wellness. But there's still that very common error of equating health and thinness as one and the same, she says. It's true. Despite all the medical and media messaging shouting otherwise, thinness and health are not the same, and fatness does not necessarily equate to being unhealthy. The good news is there's plenty you and I can do, regardless of age or gender or body type, to start freeing ourselves from this actively harmful mindset. For decades now, medical professionals have used the body mass index as the go-to measure for health, and you've likely heard many times that a high BMI can lead to disease and death, but history tells a different story. So to paraphrase this, the body mass index was created in the 19th century by a Belgian statistician. He essentially took a very small sample size and measured people's profiles based on what he thought was the ideal man, and then created this scale that became the BMI. And it's been modified a little bit over the years, but you know, I come from healthcare. I'm a nurse, and I agree. The BMI, the body mass index, is not a very good scale. In fact, when I was in nursing school, me and another guy that was also a collegiate athlete, both of us very fit, we were both overweight on the BMI. But I'm 6'2", currently about 200 pounds, and at that time I was more like 185, 190. And it said that I was obese, but if you were to see me, you could clearly say I'm not even overweight, much less obese. So the body mass index is not a good gauge. It's something that's broadly used to say, look, seems like you could lose a few pounds based on your height and weight. But you have to consider more information to really make that judgment. You can't just go off BMI. Carrying on, the author says, yet despite its many flaws, the BMI is our go-to measure for health for all genders and body types. And Strings says, many still struggle to write off the BMI because of how often it's invoked to prove that fatness leads to illness. But correlation is not causation, she says, and points to current research showing that people can be healthy at any size as long as they have the resources to do so. When I first read that, I kind of referred back to an episode I did long ago on cortisol that basically talks about and shows some graphs that your economic status in your community has a lot to do with how high your chronic levels of cortisol are. And people that are poorer tend to have, you know, a variety of different problems that can then sort of create a negative feedback loop, ending up with high cortisol, which messes with your decision-making, your reaction times, your likelihood for an accident, all kinds of things, which then if negative things happen, it increases your cortisol and you live in a constant state of stress, which can attribute to obesity. So maybe that's what they're pointing to, but this has a link in here, which I clicked and we'll get to here in just a second. Moving on, she says, access to fruits and vegetables, access to lean proteins, living in walkable neighborhoods. String says, all of these things are so important to our health outcomes. And yet, instead of looking at these factors, people want to focus just on the weight. So, you know, we could kind of say, okay, Yeah, we tend to notice the weight first and easily, and it's easy to point to, and it's easy to blame and all these things. Let's click on this article that she cited here and see what this research is that says fatness is not equal unhealthiness. So this one is from blogs.scientificamerican.com, observations. Fat is not the problem, fat stigma is. Okay, let's see this. Obesity is the biggest threat to health of our nation, proclaims the chief of epidemiology at a major medical school on the Scientific American Observation blog. This all too common suggestion does far greater damage to public health than fat tissue itself. When the focus is on weight and body size, it's not obesity that damages people. It's fear-mongering about their bodies that puts them at risk for diabetes, heart disease, discrimination, bullying, eating disorders, sedentariness, lifelong discomfort in their bodies, and even early death. Anti-obesity campaigns are so common and normalized these days that some readers might consider our claim as the outrageous one. Yet consider this: stigmatizing and imposing shame on bodies, whether individually or as a group of people, is hurtful both to the vilified fat people and the thinner people who are taught size prejudice and instilled with a fear of becoming fat. When the culture and the media world are constantly pushing the idea that obesity needs to be eliminated, it's not the fat cells that are feeling that stigma, it's the fat people. This hierarchy of bodies is nothing new. The roots in racism, slavery, and every other attempt to rank bodies. We can no longer pretend that being less likely to be hired or get promotions, being paid less, receiving biased medical treatment, being socially excluded and bullied are attempts to help people be healthier. These are the direct consequences of living in a culture that vilifies and fears fat bodies and treats the people living in them as morally lesser beings. Linda says, from my decades of challenging the pervasive fat is bad rhetoric, I know that every time I assert that the problem for fat people isn't their bodies, but abuse from society, bigotry fights back. It's not just the outright haters who populate the comment section, but worse, the self-righteous who see their stance as caring. It's all about health, their argument goes, not bias. No, it's not. Intent does not negate impact. You cannot wage war on obesity without waging war on the people who live in those obese bodies. Moreover, the dignity of a group should not be contingent on whether its members are deemed healthy, eating right, or exercising regularly. It should be obvious, but weight stigma does not reduce obesity, and healthcare should be about self-care and promoting the health of the person in all of its forms. Obesity, the word itself is a problem, pathologizing the size of a body. It is a category based on the body mass index, which is simply a mathematical equation based on height and weight. It measures physical appearance, not health. It was never intended to be used for individual health concerns, but rather for statistical analysis of a group. When the American Medical Association declared obesity a disease, it overrode a recommendation by its own expert panel, which stated that correlations between obesity and morbidity and mortality rates did not establish causality, and there was concern that medicalizing obesity would lead to further stigmatization and unnecessary treatment. Even a quick glance at the weight research shows that despite decades of trying, there is no evidence that efforts to prevent or reverse obesity are successful. In fact, there's much evidence to suggest that the prescription for weight loss is more likely to result in physical harm and weight gain. The data also refute other long-standing, widespread, and incorrect notions about health and weight, like the fact that fat is a primary driver in metabolic disease, or that the weight loss prolongs life or improves health. None of this is true. Dogma, myths, and prejudices about fatness have trumped actual evidence in our view of weight and health. It is true that many diseases are more commonly found in heavier people. However, that does not mean that weight itself causes disease. Blaming fatness for heart disease is similar to blaming yellow teeth for lung cancer. Rather than considering that smoking might play a role in both. And telling people they need to lose weight is a lot like telling someone with a cold to stop sneezing so much. It may not be possible and won't make the cold go away. Focusing on weight or health behaviors puts the burden on the individual, deflecting attention from the more pernicious problem, systemic injustice. Conditions in the places where people work and play affect health outcomes to a much larger degree than health behaviors, which all told including eating activities and other behaviors, account for less than 25% of differences in health outcomes. While health behavior change is valuable, to truly improve public health, we can work harder to create an inclusive society where everyone feels valued and has the opportunity to create a good life for themselves. Combating fat phobia needs to be part of that agenda. Okay, so a few things in here. I think she's going, again, too far, letting the pendulum swing way too far and saying that, like, anyone that's fat is more at risk because of people's hatred and anger than because of actual health risks, which I disagree with. And while some or even many people do shame overweight people for their weight, in my personal life, I don't see that as a common thing. That's rude and unnecessary and not something that normal people do. Maybe the media is trying to perpetuate it a bit because they're trying to sell products or whatever. So maybe that's true there. Also, pharmaceutical companies and all kinds of crap, they're attacking us for everything. So it doesn't matter who you are, you're under attack for some sort of sales gig that's going on. And then the thing that just about made me choke when I read it, when she says blaming fatness for heart disease is similar to blaming yellow teeth for lung cancer. It's like, well, last I knew, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think yellow teeth secrete hormones into the body that have this like cascading effect on the rest of your body's health and a variety of mechanisms of action that take place. But fat cells themselves excrete hormones. They change the composition of your body. Yellow teeth, not so much. So the comparison she makes here is a terrible one because fat actually does things to your hormones and changes the way you behave. It also changes your ability to do certain things. Now, not everybody that's overweight, you know, is struggling to get up and down stairs like my example earlier, or my humongous neighbor that couldn't catch his 3-year-old running out into the street. So, you know, maybe I'm being too dramatic as well when I bring up those examples, because I know a lot of people that are big, that are athletic, and that are healthy as far as their ability to move around, participate in sports, run long distances, get up and down stairs or up ladders, or work hard physically in construction or otherwise, right? So there's some sort of middle ground we got to find here. So in order to say that fatness has like no effect on somebody's health or lifestyle, it's like you kind of have to go to fantasy land to sort of deny that. It's like, certain things are so highly correlated that you literally have to go to like fantasy land to refute the evidence. Like XY chromosomes, for example, are so highly correlated with male features, so much so that it's the very basis for which we identify male and female. It goes deeper than the personality or subjective opinions of an individual. It's based on objective science. So blaming yellow teeth for lung cancer is not at all similar to blaming obesity for a variety of different diseases like hypertension or cardiovascular events. In fact, here's a different angle. I've taken care of patients, several of them, who were so fat that they could not lay on their back and still breathe. The pressure of the fat on their lungs caused their lungs to be ineffective. They could not get enough air to stay conscious and even alive. Whereas yellow teeth, whether you're upside down, backwards, chewing, breathing or not, they have no effect on your lung function or cancer. So it's a silly thing to say. I tried really hard to find articles on the upside of fat. Is there a positive side of this? Is, you know, having extra weight a good thing? There is one article in the Wall Street Journal that says, are there health benefits to being overweight? The subtitle is, a heart doctor says overweight people can be healthy. A public health professor says the dangers of extra weight are underestimated. So even in the title, they have to sort of fight their own evidence. Basically, they're just saying that maybe fatness isn't so much of a problem, but it's your fitness, activity, sleep habits, and things like that that actually matter more. But the funny thing is this is a vicious cycle. When your sleep sucks, you eat more and exercise less. And when you eat more and exercise less, your weight goes up. And when your weight goes up, it's associated with more sleep problems, such as sleep apnea, which we'll get into, other things that cause you to have poorer sleep, which causes you to eat more and exercise less. So, that's just the basic level. There's much more that goes on, right? There's insulin resistance, and there's all kinds of other problems that come up as a result of this pattern. And so this article just didn't have a lot. It says, yes, being fit is more important than being an ideal weight. First and foremost, I don't promote overweightness or obesity or suggest that normal-sized people gain weight. That said, fat isn't always the demon it is made out to be when it comes to the person's long-term health and mortality. In a perfect world, everyone would be lean, fit, and metabolically healthy, maintaining balanced blood sugar levels, healthy lipid profiles, and good blood pressure throughout life. However, this is far from the case in the U.S., where nearly 3 out of 4 adults are classified as either overweight or obese. Skipping ahead, a major study in 2013 published in the Journal of American Medical Association and led by Catherine Flegel for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that although obesity was associated with much higher risk of death, it was all due to the higher mortality in moderate and severely obese people or those with body mass indexes greater than 35 and 40 respectively. The mildly obese or those with BMIs of 30 to 34 actually had a 5% lower mortality than did the normal BMI subjects, which was quite statistically significant. More important, the overweight people or those with BMIs between 25 and 29 had the lowest mortality rate and significant 6% lower mortality rate than the normal BMI subjects, according to the researchers who analyzed 97 studies involving nearly 2.9 million adults. So it sounds like maybe being slightly overweight doesn't necessarily contribute to mortality or even is helpful. We know that certain things in our bodies, like our brains, are made completely of cholesterol. And so perhaps there's some, biology at play here that's saying, like, if you have a little bit of extra weight, you have the resources available in your body to do extra work, extra things that might maintain health longer. But even still, they're suggesting that it is more your lifestyle, the amount of good sleep you get, the exercise habits, the nutrition you have, those play a bigger part than your weight. But only those that were slightly overweight had any advantage. The ones that were very overweight had no advantage at all. So let's just talk a little bit about some of the science at a basic level of how fat is correlated with illness. If you refer back to the episode Effects of Diet on Hormones and Mental Illness, I describe in some detail how fat secretes hormones and actually triggers early puberty for obese children. And if that's not an excellent example for how fat actually changes your body composition and your health, I don't know what is. But let's go on to some other research here. This one is from the National Library of Medicine, National Center for Biotechnology Information. It's a pretty long article, as many research articles are so detail-oriented, but in conclusion here, diabetes and obesity are chronic disorders that are on the rise worldwide. Body mass index has a strong relationship to diabetes and insulin resistance. In an obese individual, the amount of NEFA, glycerol, hormones, cytokines, pro-inflammatory substances, and other substances that are involved in the development of insulin resistance are increased. Insulin resistance with impairment of B cell function leads to the development of diabetes. Gaining weight in early life is associated with the development of type 1 diabetes. NEFA is a cornerstone in the development of insulin resistance and in the impairment of B cell function. New approaches in managing and preventing diabetes in obese individuals must be studied and investigated based on these facts. In case you don't know what NEFA is, that stands for non-esterified fatty acid or free fatty acids. They are an important metabolic fuel. Both the concentration of NEFA and their flux through the circulation vary widely from hour to hour, reflecting nutritional state and physical activity. On to the next. This is from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. In September 29th, 2014, public health and safety are threatened by the increasing prevalence of obstructive sleep apnea, which now affects at least 25 million adults in the U.S. According to the National Healthy Sleep Awareness Project, several new studies highlight the destructive nature of obstructive sleep apnea, a chronic disease that increases the risk of high blood pressure and heart disease, type 2 diabetes, stroke, and depression. Obstructive sleep apnea is destroying the health of millions of Americans, and the problem has only gotten worse over the last two decades, said American Academy of Sleep Medicine President Dr. Timothy Morgenthaler, a national spokesperson for the Healthy Sleep Project. The effective treatment of sleep apnea is one of the keys to success as our nation attempts to reduce healthcare spending and improve chronic disease management. Data previously published in the American Journal of Epidemiology show that the estimated prevalence rates of obstructive sleep apnea have increased substantially over the last two decades, most likely due to the obesity pandemic. It is now estimated that 26% of adults between the ages of 30 and 70 years have sleep apnea. Can you believe that? 26%? Findings from new studies emphasize the negative effects of sleep apnea on brain and heart health. However, these health risks can be reduced through the effective treatment of sleep apnea with continuous positive air pressure therapy. And he goes on to describe a bit about the, you know, some of the treatments there. So sleep apnea being one of the problems, but obese people have higher rates of sleep apnea. So I went on a search for some of that. Now this one from the American Heart Association, it's really based on hypertension, but it says obesity, sleep apnea, and hypertension. So the abstract, obesity has a high and rising prevalence and represents a major public health problem. Obstructive sleep apnea is also common, affecting an estimated 15 million Americans, with a prevalence that is probably also rising as the consequence of increasing obesity. Epidemiologic data support a link between obesity and hypertension, as well as between OSA and hypertension. For example, untreated OSA predisposes to an increased risk of new hypertension, and treatment of OSA lowers blood pressure even during the daytime. Possible mechanisms whereby OSA may contribute to hypertension in obese individuals include sympathetic activation, hyperleptinemia, insulin resistance, elevated angiotensin II, and aldosterone levels, oxidative and inflammatory stress, endothelial dysfunction, impaired baroreflex function, and perhaps by effects on renal function. The coexistence of OSA and obesity may have more widespread implications for cardiovascular control and dysfunction in obese individuals and may contribute to some of the clustering of abnormalities broadly defined as the metabolic syndrome. From the clinical and therapeutic perspectives, the presence of resistant hypertension and the absence of a nocturnal decrease in blood pressure in obese individuals should prompt the clinician to consider the diagnosis of OSA, especially if clinical symptoms suggestive of OSA, such as poor sleep quality, witnessed apnea, excessive daytime somnolence, and so forth, are also present. So obesity, prevalence and association with hypertension. They go into a whole bunch of data there. I'll just spare you that. I want to get to the sleep apnea portion. Among the risk of factors for OSA, obesity is probably the most important. Several cross-sectional studies have consistently found an association between increased body weight and the risk of OSA. Significant sleep apnea is present in 40% of obese individuals and 70% of OSA patients are obese. So, I mean, maybe you could make a claim chicken and the egg, which one comes first? You have sleep problems, therefore you become fat, or you become fat and that causes sleep problems, or maybe a combination of both going back and forth, as I described earlier. The book, Why We Sleep, one of my favorite books on sort of the science of the body, just very, very interesting information there. So there's an episode on that if you want to check it out. But Dr. Walker describes in there how when you get poor sleep, certain hormones are changed, such as ghrelin, and you feel hungrier throughout the day. Your decision-making is worse as it pertains to food choices and quality of food. And so when you get poor sleep because of sleep apnea or otherwise, you make poor decisions about nutrition. You're also depleted of energy. Your willpower is sort of sapped a bit. Your emotions are much more bipolar. So all kinds of things change because of sleep. And then if that results in poor decision-making, then you eat too many calories, you eat poorer nutrition, and then you continue to get bad sleep. I mean, these cycles are just going to get worse and worse. And then as you get more fat, you're secreting more hormones from your from the adipose tissue. Things just get kind of out of hand, right? Now, I want to circle back because I feel like I've gone so far to the other side saying like fatness is a problem, right? But lifestyle matters an incredible amount here. Whether it's fatness that's the problem or poor sleep that's the problem, some of the cures, some of the things that are good for you to combat that is to do your best to get good sleep. So follow things like getting up at the same time every day, getting sunlight in your eyes early, getting exercise earlier in the day, avoiding a lot of light, especially blue light and media, just a couple hours before bedtime. Don't eat with less than 2 hours before going to sleep. Go to sleep at the same time every day in a quiet, cool environment, right? Improve your sleep. And if you have sleep apnea, find treatment for that sleep apnea. Exercise regularly, because exercise also another thing that just changes the hormones of your body like crazy, right? Get those intentional surges of cortisol from certain types of stress and pressure that then go away as you relax and come off of that. Mental health. Try and work on your mental health, because living in a state of chronic stress will jack up anybody, and you'll live with high cortisol levels, which has a cascading negative effect. Try to optimize your nutrition. Eat healthy foods that can give your body what you need. I mean, I'm no dietitian, but generally eat whole foods, things that are going to give you a nice balance between all the vitamins and minerals you need, the protein, the fats and cholesterol, a proper number of calories so that you have a high functioning mind and body. And seek out strong social connection. If we learned anything from the episode on how to live to be 100 years old in these blue zones, is they are strongly connected with their social groups, both families and communities. So try and implement some of these strategies into your life, and maybe the sleep improves, maybe the exercise improves, maybe the fatness improves. And I do agree that you don't have to be super thin to be an ideal body weight, because every body is truly different. Every single person, look at a lot of these NFL players and things like that. There's a bunch of guys out there that are really carrying around a lot of fat, but they also exercise regularly very hard. They're super strong. They're actually very fast, a lot of them. And, you know, their bodies are just built differently. Every body is very different, and a lot of it goes into your lifestyle, but your lifestyle contributes to how much fat you'll have, and having too much fat clearly has negative effects. But being too fat doesn't make you a bad person, right? Just like somebody who gambles too much or drinks too much or eats too much or didn't get the proper education or grew up in an area with no diversity or whatever. Like, those things don't make you bad. It's just something that you could build upon, learn from, grow from, right? And so again, as I started this episode, I bring it back to saying somewhere in the middle is where the right balance is. Being a victim and acting like everyone's shaming you because of your fat, and that fat is actually not responsible for any negative effects in your body. It's just the shame of other people that present that brings negative effects. That's not true. But getting people to be thin is not the answer either. Trying to preach thinness doesn't really help. It's about health, healthy lifestyle. And truly, there is a clear delineation across the board for economic status. And so having good resources and the ability to live a balanced life does impact people's overall health and wellness. So, you know, we can't be ignorant to that. Anyway, guys, kind of a different episode, referencing a lot of different things and kind of maybe on a political light here, but let me know what you think of this format and how you like the content here. I think it's worth kind of examining where you stand on things and understanding that hard-nosed, closed-minded people often are leaving out a lot of reality and truth, as are those who sort of go, you know what? Let's stop blaming what has always been blamed and blame something new. Well, the reality is probably both have some truth. And then you got to remember that big businesses are seeking money. And so they're not always after your best interests. So they're marketing to you. They're perpetuating certain things. And it's not always for health, right? Lastly, I just want to mention to you guys, my friends over at Magic Mind. This is not a sponsored ad, but I have worked with them a little bit, and I love their product. So Magic Mind, it's just a little 2-ounce shot that you can take in the morning as part of your morning routine. It's got some caffeine in it, but it also has other ingredients that help prolong the effects of those that caffeine, so you don't get that rise and fall kind of reaction that you do when you just drink energy drinks or coffee. It also has adaptogens that help you relax. So it's just this awesome little 2-ounce fluid shot that sort of helps you get into that focused place to get your to-do list done. And I've really enjoyed it. So go over to Magic Mind and check it out. Also, we have a new shirt available in the store on the website. So go to bronsonwilkes.com, go purchase your shirt or purchase that ebook, Ingrained, how to implement new habits into your life. And I appreciate you guys showing up yet again, and I hope you continue to come back. Also, I'd love to hear from you on Instagram. Go to Build the Life You Want, BW, on Instagram, and hit me up over there. Let's get you engaged in the conversations on another level. So appreciate you guys. We'll catch you on the next one. Hey, thanks for listening to the entire episode. As a token of gratitude, I want to give you a discount on my book, Ingrained. Head over to bronsonwilkes.com/store and download Ingrained for less than $1 with the coupon code GOALS, GOALS.